Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, November 13th, 2019. This is a special report, special coverage of the launch of the public impeachment hearings of President Donald Trump in the House of Representatives, Capitol Hill, Washington, D.C., United States of America. Ladies and gentlemen, everybody is convening there right now. People are getting settled. They're taking pictures. They're making notes. It looks like they're still waiting for a lot of people. So let me just tell you what we're going to be doing today, folks. We're going to be covering this. We're basically going to be streaming. I'm not going to do a lot of talking, although I might. I don't know. I really don't know what we're going to be doing here. So we're going to we'll check it out, and we will see. And then we're going to be covering this until the noon show, noon Eastern, and at which time we're going to make an assessment. Either way, we're going to sign off and restart the show, and we're going to make an assessment as to what's going on in the hearings at that time. Now, we can never know, you know, what the deal is, but it appears as if the Democrats have made a concerted effort to make sure that the first hour of each person's testimony today, and we should say the testimony is coming from Bill Taylor, who was a former ambassador brought in by the Trump administration to basically be the only professional working, a diplomatic professional working in terms of Ukraine. He is the one who was sort of like the Serpico in this story, the guy who was not involved in this corruption and was like, hey, wait a second, what's going on here? For some reason, they thought that he would be down with it, I guess. Or they had Sondland dealing with him, and Sondland is a hotelier, so he probably assumed that he could deal with it. The other person who is going to be here is George Kent. And Kent is a, let me just pull this up here. Kent is a State Department official, and he is going to speak to the fact that what the Trump administration really wanted from Ukraine was just say the words Clinton, Biden in 2016 in a press conference and the word investigate. And then you get your money and then you get to have your your meeting with the president. And that was what we call in Latin a this for that. We call that actually, that's English. In Latin, it's called a quid pro quo. In impeachment talk, that is what is known as a bribe. This for that. It can also be extortion, as it's sort of like you have this coming, but if you don't give me that, you won't get the other that. I guess it's a quid pro quid. is an extortion. Is that what that right? Is it? Do we know that for a fact? Or did I just make that up?
No, I think that's right.
I think I may have just made that up. And the Republicans, they're... okay, so now you have the witnesses are coming in. That is Taylor, the first guy. Kent is the second guy. And they're going to get sworn in. They're going to testify. I don't know. Is this being covered? Can we check and see who's covering this and who's not? I mean, you know, back in the day, this would have been on ABC, NBC, and CBS. In this day, it may be, I would imagine, on all the cable television channels. One would hope. C-SPAN apparently is now like they've hired a shooter from like MTV in 1993. And as you can see, everybody's surrounding these guys. Everybody needs their picture. I don't know why they can't just do a pool picture, but that's just the way it is. There's all the reporters there on their computers. Okay, everybody's sitting down now, so we're gonna get rolling with this. Like I say, the Democrats are insisting on having a doing this up front, like having all the good stuff up in the first hour. I don't know if they're going to go back and forth to both witnesses simultaneously. It sort of appears that way. The lawyer who's going to be working for the Democrats is a guy named Goldman. He is a former mob prosecutor. Apropos, seems to me. And Schiff is about to begin.
Committee will come to order. Good morning, everyone. This is the first in a series of public hearings the committee will be holding as part of the House's impeachment inquiry. Without objection, the chair is authorized to declare a recess of the committee at any time. There is a quorum present. Here's how the committee will proceed for this hearing. I will make an opening statement, and then Ranking Member Nunes will have the opportunity to make a statement. Then we will go to witness statements and then to questions. For audience members, we welcome you, and we respect your interest in being here. In turn, we ask for your respect as we proceed with today's hearing.
Mr. Chairman.
It is the intention of the committee to proceed without disruptions.
Mr. Chairman, before, what may I make a parliamentary inquiry?
Chairman, we'll state the inquiry.
Mr. Chairman, this is our first hearing under these new set of rules. House Resolution 660 gives you the discretion to allow yourself and the ranking member periods of extended questions of up to 45 minutes each before other members are allowed to ask questions. If possible, we'd like to know the rules of engagement before we get started. Have you made a decision yet as to how many 45-minute rounds you will allow yourself and the ranking member?
I have not. As we informed the minority yesterday, we will see how the first period goes and how much material we're able to get through. At that point, the chair will announce the period, if there is a period of the second round, which may be up to 45 minutes, or we'll go straight to 5-minute questions by members. For audience members, again, we welcome you and your interest. In turn, we expect and will insist on decorum in the committee. As chairman, I'll take all necessary and appropriate steps to maintain order and ensure the committee is run in accordance with House rules and House Resolution 660. With that, I now recognize myself to give an opening statement in the impeachment inquiry into Donald J. Trump, the 45th President of the United States. In 2014, Russia invaded the United States' ally, Ukraine, to reverse that nation's embrace of the West and to fulfill Vladimir Putin's desire to rebuild a Russian empire. In the following years, 14,000 Ukrainians died as they battled superior Russian forces. Earlier this year, Vladimir Zelensky was elected president of Ukraine on a platform of ending the conflict and tackling corruption. He was a newcomer to politics and immediately sought to establish a relationship with Ukraine's most powerful patron, the United States. The questions presented by this impeachment inquiry are whether President Trump sought to exploit that ally's vulnerability and invite Ukraine's interference in our elections, whether President Trump sought to condition official acts such as a White House meeting or U.S. military assistance, on Ukraine's willingness to assist with two political investigations that would help his reelection campaign. And if President Trump did either, whether such an abuse of his power is compatible with the office of the presidency. The matter is as simple and as terrible as that. Our answer to these questions will affect not only the future of this presidency, but the future of the presidency itself, and what kind of conduct or misconduct the American people may come to expect from their commander-in-chief. There are few actions as consequential as the impeachment of a president. While the founders did not intend that impeachment be employed for mere differences over policy, they also made impeachment a constitutional process that the Congress must utilize as necessary. The facts in the present inquiry are not seriously contested. Beginning in January of this year, the president's personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, pressed Ukrainian authorities to investigate Burisma, the country's largest natural gas producer, and the Bidens, since Vice President Joe Biden was seen as a strong potential challenger to Trump. Giuliani also promoted a debunked conspiracy that it was Ukraine, not Russia, that hacked the 2016 U.S. election. The nation's intelligence agencies have stated unequivocally that it was Russia, not Ukraine, that interfered in our election. But Giuliani believed this conspiracy theory, referred to as CrowdStrike, shorthand for the company that discovered the Russian hack, would aid his client's reelection. Giuliani also conducted a smear campaign against the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch. On April 29, a senior State Department official told her that although she had done nothing wrong, President Trump had lost confidence in her. With the sidelining of Yovanovitch, the stage was set for the establishment of an irregular channel in which Giuliani and later others, including Gordon Sondland, an influential donor to the president's inauguration, now serving as ambassador to the European Union, could advance the president's personal and political interests. Yovanovitch's replacement in Kiev, Ambassador Bill Taylor, is a West Point graduate and a Vietnam veteran. As he began to better understand the scheme through the summer of 2019, he pushed back, informing Deputy Assistant Secretary Kent and others about a plan to condition U.S. government actions and funding on the performance of political favors by the Ukrainian government, favors intended for President Trump that would undermine our security and our elections. Several key events in this scheme took place in the month of July. On July 10th, Ambassador Sondland informed a group of U.S. and Ukrainian officials meeting at the White House that, according to you, Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney, a White House meeting desperately sought by the Ukrainian president with Trump would happen only if Ukraine undertook an investigation into the energy sector, which was understood to mean Burisma and specifically the Bidens. National Security Advisor Bolton abruptly ended the meeting and said afterwards that he would not be, quote, part of whatever drug deal Sondland and Mulvaney are cooking up on this, end quote. A week later, on July 18th,
incidentally,
representative of the Office of Management and Budget, the White House agency that oversees federal spending, announced on a video
back
conference
in his days in D.C.
that Mulvaney, at the direction of the president,
nothing wrong with that,
was freezing nearly $400 million in security assistance authorized and appropriated by Congress, and which the entirety of the U.S. national security establishment supported. 1 week after that, Donald Trump would have the now infamous July 25th phone call with Ukrainian President Zelensky. During that call, Trump complained that the U.S. relationship with Ukraine had not been reciprocal. Later, Zelensky thanks Trump for his support in the area of defense and says that Ukraine is ready to purchase more javelins, an anti-tank weapon that was among the most important deterrents of further Russian military action.
I need a favor.
Trump's immediate response, I would like you to do us a favor, though. Trump then requested that Zelensky investigate the discredited 2016 CrowdStrike conspiracy theory,
quid pro,
and
though,
even more ominously look into the Bidens. Neither of these investigations was in the U.S. national interest, and neither was part of the official preparatory material for the call. Both, however, were in Donald Trump's personal interest and in the interests of his 2020 reelection campaign. And the Ukrainian president knew about both in advance because Sondland and others had been pressing Ukraine for weeks about investigations into the 2016 election, Burisma, and the Bidens. After the call, multiple individuals were concerned enough to report it to the National Security Council's top lawyer. The White House would then take the extraordinary step of moving the call record to a highly classified server exclusively reserved for the most sensitive intelligence matters.
Yeah, I was sentimental.
In the weeks that followed, Ambassador Taylor learned new facts about a scheme that Sondland would describe as becoming more insidious. Taylor texted Sondland, quote, "Are we now saying that security assistance and White House meeting are conditioned on investigations?" As summer turned to fall, it kept getting more insidious, Mr. Sondland testified. Mr. Taylor, who took notes of his conversation, said the ambassador told him in a September 1st phone call that everything was dependent on the public announcement of investigations, including security assistance. President Trump wanted Mr. Zelensky in a public box. President Trump is a businessman, Sondland said later. When a businessman is about to sign a check to someone who owes him something, the businessman asks that person to pay up before signing the check.
Sondland didn't mean to.
In a sworn declaration after
Trump
Taylor's testimony,
he was owed something for money.
Sondland would admit to telling Ukrainians
do.
At a September 1st meeting in Warsaw.
But he did.
Quote, that resumption of U.S. aid would likely not occur until Ukraine provided the public anti-corruption statement that we have been discussing for many weeks. The president's chief of staff confirmed Trump's efforts to coerce Ukraine by withholding aid. When Mick Mulvaney was asked publicly about it, his answer was breathtaking. We do that all the time with foreign policy,
whoops,
he said. I have news for everybody. Get over it. There's going to be political influence in foreign policy. That is going to happen. The video of that confession is plain for all to see. Some have argued in the president's defense that the aid was ultimately released, and that is true. But only after Congress began an investigation, only after the president's lawyers learned of a whistleblower complaint, and only after members of Congress began asking uncomfortable questions about quid pro quos.
If you screw up the bank
heist,
it's not illegal.
Funding to obtain a personal political benefit.
If there's no gas in the getaway car, not illegal.
Because it is discovered before it is fully consummated. In fact, the security assistance had been delayed so long it would take another act of Congress to ensure that it could still go out. And that Oval Office meeting that Zelensky desperately sought, it still hasn't happened. Although we have learned a great deal about these events in the last several weeks, there are still missing pieces. The president has instructed the State Department and other agencies to ignore congressional subpoenas for documents. He has instructed witnesses to defy subpoenas and refuse to appear. And he has suggested that those who do expose wrongdoing should be treated like traitors and spies. These actions will force Congress to consider, as it did with President Nixon, whether Trump's obstruction of the constitutional duties of Congress constitute additional grounds for impeachment. If the president can simply refuse all oversight, particularly in the context of an impeachment proceeding, the balance of power between our two branches of government will be irrevocably altered. That is not what the founders intended. And the prospects for further corruption and abuse of power in this administration or any other will be exponentially increased. This is what we believe the testimony will show, both as to the president's conduct and as to his obstruction of Congress. The issue that we confront is the one posed by the president's acting chief of staff when he challenged Americans to get over it. If we find that the president of the United States abused his power and invited foreign interference in our elections, or if he sought to
I feel like this could have been
coerce,
a little peppier,
extort, or bribe
a little
an ally
shorter. He's trying to be being serious about it.
To aid
it's
his
a big deal.
And did so
impeachment
by
does not happen all
acts.
The time. It's the fourth time in the history of America it's happened. So Schiff feels like he's got to lay it out. Frankly, in this day and age, I think maybe a three charts with bullet points may have been more effective.
What is?
The witnesses will show that Donald Trump did this. The witness will show that Donald Trump did that. The witness will show that Donald Trump did this. The witness will show that Donald Trump did that.
Setting ambition against ambition so we become no
This is called bribery or extortion. This is the Constitution. The Constitution says that bribery is specifically a cause for impeachment. And now it's up to Devin Nunes to talk about how Hillary Clinton killed Vince Foster and why Donald Trump should be president for another 12 years. And that's basically it.
Raised by the impeachment inquiry into Donald J. Trump is, can we keep it? I now recognize Ranking Member Nunes for any remarks he may wish to make.
Sham.
Thanks, gentlemen. In a July open hearing of this committee following publication of the Mueller report,
Al Green said
Democrats
that
engaged
you need
in a
last-ditch
effort to convince the American people that President Trump is a Russian agent. That hearing was the pitiful finale of a three-year-long operation by the Democrats, the corrupt media,
incidentally,
and partisan bureaucrats to overturn the results of the 2016
election. The Trump campaign got its first heads up about
After
Julian Assange's ability to upend U.S. politics as far back as April 2016.
They spent years denouncing any
Timing is months earlier than any Trump aide has previously described, which means they all lied about it when they testified or spoke to Mueller, and months before WikiLeaks published its first cache of damaging materials that would go on to cripple Clinton's White House bid. That's a little bit more editorial than I think is probably appropriate, but Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, campaign chairman Manafort, Steve Bannon, Steve Miller, were all part of a broader discussions on how best to turn the WikiLeaks surprises into political gold. Trump himself discussed the matter with Stone during a phone call in the heat of the summertime general election campaign. It's according to testimony from Rick Gates, who witnessed the call while riding with Trump from Trump Tower to LaGuardia Airport. And Trump incidentally lied in his written response to Mueller. I don't recall discussing WikiLeaks with Stone, et cetera, et cetera. Anyways, back.
The last people on earth with the credibility to hurl more preposterous accusations at their political opponents.
Oh, incidentally. Moo.
Here we are. We're supposed to take these
That's
people at
Devin
face
Nunes's
value when they
cow.
Trot out a new batch of allegations. But anyone familiar with the Democrats' scorched earth war against President Trump would not be surprised to see all the typical signs that this is a carefully orchestrated media smear campaign. For example, after vowing publicly that impeachment requires bipartisan support, Democrats are pushing impeachment forward without the backing of a single Republican. The witnesses deemed suitable for television by the Democrats were put through a closed-door audition process in a cult-like atmosphere in the basement of the Capitol, where Democrats conducted secret depositions, released a flood of
cult-like?
Misleading and one-sided leaks,
demonic Democrats
and later
in the
selectively
that,
released transcripts in a highly staged
Actually,
manner.
Grab the vodka.
Violating their own guidelines, Democrats repeatedly redacted from the transcripts the name of Alexander Chalupa, a contractor for the Democratic National Committee, who worked with Ukrainian officials to collect dirt on the Trump campaign, which she provided to the DNC and the Hillary Clinton campaign. The Democrats rejected most of the Republicans' witness requests, resulting in a horrifically one-sided process where the crucial witnesses are denied a platform if their testimony does not support the Democrats' absurd accusations. Notably, they are trying to impeach the president for inquiring about Hunter Biden's activities. Yet they refuse our request to hear from Biden himself.
I'm the chief law enforcement officer of the country.
Bias against President Trump
Chief and his Biden attorney touted enforcement a coup officer of the country. The president, why would that be weird?
And called for his impeachment just weeks after the election. At a prior hearing, Democrats on this committee read out a purely fictitious rendition of the president's phone call with President Zelensky. They clearly found the real conversation to be insufficient for their impeachment narrative, so they just made up a new one. And most egregiously, the staff of the Democrats on this committee had direct discussions with the whistleblower before his or her complaint was submitted to the Inspector General. Republicans can't get a full account of these contacts because Democrats broke their promise to have the whistleblower testify to this committee. Democrat members hid these contacts from Republicans and then lied about them to the American people on national television. I've noted before, the Democrats have a long habit of accusing Republicans of offenses they themselves are committing. Let's recall, for years they accused the Trump campaign of colluding with Russia when they themselves were colluding with Russia by funding and spreading the Steele dossier, which relied on Russian sources. And now they accuse President Trump of malfeasance in Ukraine when they themselves are culpable. The Democrats cooperated in Ukrainian election meddling, and they defend Hunter Biden's securing of a lavishly paid position with a corrupt Ukrainian company, all while his father served as vice president.
That's despite why I ran to deal with Hunter Biden.
Impeachment sham. But we should not hold any hearings at all until we get answers to three crucial questions the Democrats are determined to avoid asking. First,
where's
what is the full
Vince
extent
Foster,
of the Democrats'
Barry.
Prior coordination with the whistleblower? And who else did the whistleblower coordinate this effort with? Second, what is the full extent of Ukraine's election meddling against the Trump campaign? And third, why did Burisma hire Hunter Biden, and what did he do for them, and did his position affect any U.S. government actions under the Obama administration? These questions will remain outstanding because Republicans were denied the right to call witnesses that know these answers. What we will witness today is a televised theatrical performance staged by the Democrats. Ambassador Taylor and Mr. Kent, I'd like to welcome you here. I'd like to congratulate you for passing the Democrat Star Chamber auditions held for the last weeks in the basement of the Capitol.
The Star Chamber. Republicans were there too, incidentally.
Or unwittingly, to participate in a drama. But the main performance, the Russia hoax, has ended, and you've been cast in the low-rent Ukrainian sequel. I'll conclude by noting the immense damage the politicized bureaucracy has done to Americans' faith in government. Though executive branch employees are charged with implementing the policies set
rich,
by our president,
yes.
who is elected and responsible to the American people, elements of the civil service have decided that they, not the president, are really in charge. Thus, as we'll learn in these hearings, after expressing skepticism of foreign aid and concern about foreign corruption on the campaign trail, President Trump
Vulcan,
outraged the bureaucracy
standing, sitting behind,
by acting
Nunes
skeptically
on his right
about
there.
Foreign aid and expressing concerns about foreign corruption.
Is he
corruption.
A Vulcan or a Romulan?
Officials' alarm at the president's actions was typically based on second-hand,
yes.
third-hand, and even fourth-hand rumors and innuendo. They believed it was an outrage for the president to fire an ambassador, even though the president has full authority to retain or remove diplomats for any reason
at
any time.
I can do whatever I want.
Officials show the surprising lack of interest in the indications of Ukrainian election meddling.
Look at the Constitution.
Deeply
I can
concerned
do whatever
the president
I want.
At whose pleasure they serve. Despite all their dissatisfaction with President Trump's Ukraine policy, the president approved the supply of weapons to Ukraine. Unlike the previous administration, which provided blankets as defense against invading Russians. By undermining the president, who they are supposed to be serving, the elements of the FBI, the Department of Justice, and now the State Department, have lost the confidence of millions of Americans who believe that their vote should count for something. It will take years, if not decades, to restore faith in these institutions. This spectacle is doing great damage to our country. It's nothing more than an impeachment process in search of a crime. That I yield back.
Today we are joined by Ambassador
all crisis actors.
Assistant Secretary of State George Kent, both of whom are appearing under subpoena. Ambassador William Taylor has served our country for over half a century. He attended U.S. Military Academy at West Point, graduating in the top 1% of his class, before serving as an infantry officer in the U.S. Army for 6 years, including with the 101st Airborne Division during the Vietnam War. Ambassador Taylor led a rifle platoon in Vietnam and was awarded the Bronze Star Medal and the Air Medal for Valor. Following his military service, he worked at the Department of Energy as a staffer in the U.S. Senate, as an advisor as well to U.S. Ambassador to NATO. In the 1990s, Ambassador Taylor coordinated U.S. assistance to Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union, and later served in Afghanistan, Iraq, and worked on the Middle East peace process. In 2006, President Bush nominated him as ambassador to Ukraine, where he served until 2009, and then was appointed by President Barack Obama to be special coordinator for Middle East transitions. Ambassador Taylor was serving as the executive vice president of the nonpartisan U.S. Institute for Peace when, in June 2019, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo asked him to return to lead the U.S. embassy in Kiev as chargé d'affaires. Mr. George Kent currently serves as Deputy Assistant Secretary in the Department of State's Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs, overseeing policy
now,
towards Ukraine and other countries.
The reason why
he has
Nunes
served twice in Ukraine from 2004 to 2007
basically framed it as if these two were being used by the Democrats, as if they were crisis actors hired by the Democrats playing a role in this movie. Is that they're a little worried about trying to smear these guys? It's harder for them to do this. So the next best thing is to say they've been duped. They're good guys, just a little dim. The Democrats are evil. They came out of their star chamber. They had this production ready, and they cast these guys in this role, and these guys have no idea what they're doing or talking about or any competency to do anything other than, of course, what they were tasked to do by the Trump administration. That's sort of the problem they have a little bit.
And raise your right hand. I will begin by swearing you in.
Back in the day, this is when I would be taking pictures of my TV to make refrigerator magnets to sell them at the local bar for beer money.
The whole truth and nothing
but
the truth.
But now I'm older, and everything's digital, so nobody cares.
The record show that the witnesses answered in the affirmative. Thank you, and please be seated.
This was
pre,
like barely a VHS.
Before we hear from the witnesses, I have a parliamentary inquiry.
Here we go. Here come the Republicans with their...
Mr. Chairman, when can we anticipate a response to our November 9th letter requesting certain individual witnesses to be called?
The gentlewoman should be aware that three of the witnesses the minority has requested are scheduled for next week.
Those were your witnesses, Mr. Chairman. What about the additional six witnesses?
The gentlewoman may inquire about additional witnesses or make a request for a vote on additional witnesses following the witness testimony.
And, Mr. Chairman, I have a point of order under H. Res. 660.
The gentlewoman will state her point of order.
Mr. Chairman, will you be prohibiting witnesses from answering members' questions as you have in the closed-door depositions?
As the gentlewoman should know, if she was present for the deposition.
Which I was, Mr. Chairman.
For some of them, yes.
Correct.
The only times I prevented witnesses from answering questions, along with their counsel, was when it was apparent that members were seeking to out the whistleblower. We will do everything necessary to protect the whistleblower's identity, and I'm disturbed to hear members of the committee who have in the past voiced strong support for whistleblower protections seek to undermine those protections by outing the whistleblower.
So Mr. Chairman, only one member and their staff on this committee has direct knowledge of the identity of the whistleblower.
The gentlewoman will suspend. You asked a parliamentary inquiry, and I am responding, or a point of order, and I am responding. We will not permit the outing of the whistleblower, and questions along those lines, counsel will inform their clients not to respond to. If necessary, I will intervene Otherwise, I want members to feel free to ask any questions they like.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to make a motion, Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry. This is an opportunity for members
and get all
to ask
the rest
any questions they
record.
Like. The gentleman is not recognized.
Mr. Conaway, Mr. Chairman.
I'm responding to the gentlewoman's point of order. Otherwise, members will have every opportunity to ask any questions they like. Mr. Conaway, do you seek recognition for what purpose?
I seek recognition to make a motion that we actually subpoena the whistleblower for a closed-door, secret deposition so that the questions that should be appropriately asked the whistleblower by our side and your side may be asked. And I would prefer that rather than it be your single decision, that the committee speak to that issue rather than just the chairman. And I move that we...
I thank the gentleman. It won't be my single
subpoena
decision.
Subpoena the whistleblower.
It won't be my single decision. We will entertain a motion to subpoena any witness, but after the witnesses have had an opportunity to testify,
that
motion will be in order, but that motion will be suspended until after the witnesses
testify. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, do you anticipate when we would vote
what
on
purpose
that?
Does Mr. Jordan seek recognition?
Just to ask a
I
question.
Want to just defend the doctor on the wrestling team.
To have the whistleblower in front of us, something you, the 435 members of Congress, you are the only member who knows who that individual is, and your staff is the only staff of any member of Congress who's had a chance to talk with that individual. We would like that opportunity. When
just a reminder, he's been credibly accused
today.
By two different people
first,
now.
As the gentleman knows,
of protecting
I do not know the identity of the whistleblower, and I'm determined to make sure
a student
that
predator
is protected. But as I said to Mr. Conaway, you'll have an opportunity after the witnesses testify to make a motion to subpoena any witness and compel a vote. And with that, I now recognize the witnesses. Before I do, I want to just emphasize the microphones are sensitive, so please speak directly into them. Without objection, your written statements will be made part of the record. And with that, Deputy Assistant Secretary Kent, you are recognized for your opening statement. Ambassador Taylor, you are recognized immediately thereafter for your opening statement.
Good morning. My name is George Kent, and I am the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Eastern Europe and the Caucasus. I have served proudly as a nonpartisan career foreign service officer for more than 27 years under five presidents, three Republican and two Democrat.
Oh, so two Democrats.
As I mentioned in my opening comments last month in the closed-door deposition, I represent the third generation of my family to have chosen a career in public service and sworn the oath of office that all U.S. public servants do in defense of our Constitution. Indeed, there has been a George Kent sworn to defend the Constitution continuously for nearly 60 years, ever since my father reported to Annapolis for his plebe summer. After graduating first in his Naval Academy class in 1965, the year best known for his Heisman-winning classmate Roger Staubach, my father served a full honorable 30 years, including as a captain of a nuclear ballistic missile submarine during the height of the Cold War. Five great uncles served honorably in the Navy and the Army in World War II. In particular, Tom Taggart was stationed in the Philippines at the time of the attack on Pearl Harbor. He survived the brutal Bataan Death March and 3.5 years in a Japanese prisoner of war camp unbroken. He returned to service as an Air Force judge advocate, upholding the rule of law until his death in 1965. Today, I appear before you once again, under subpoena, as a fact witness, ready to answer all of your questions about the events and developments examined in this inquiry, to the best of my ability and recollection, subject to the limits placed on me by the law and this process. I will begin with some opening comments on the key principles at the heart of what brings me for you today, to wit, principled public service in pursuit of our enduring national interests and the place of Ukraine in our national and security interests. For the past 5 years, we have focused our united efforts across the Atlantic to support Ukraine in its fight for the cause of freedom and the rebirth of a country free from Russian dominion and the warped legacy of Soviet institutions and post-Soviet behavior. As I stated in my closed-door deposition last month, you don't step into the public arena of international diplomacy in active pursuit of principled U.S. interests without expecting vigorous pushback, including personal attacks. Such attacks came from the Russians, their proxies, and corrupt Ukrainians. That tells me our efforts were hitting their mark. It was unexpected and most unfortunate, however, to watch some Americans, including those who allied themselves with corrupt Ukrainians in pursuit of private agendas, launch attacks on dedicated public servants advancing U.S. interests in Ukraine. In my opinion, those attacks undermined U.S. and Ukrainian national interests and damaged our critical bilateral relationship. The United States has very clear national interests at stake in Ukraine. Ukraine's success is very much in our national interest, in the way we have defined our national interest broadly in Europe for the past 75 years. After World War II, U.S. leadership furthered far-sighted policies like the Marshall Plan and the creation of a rules-based international order. Protected by the collective security provided by NATO, Western Europe recovered and thrived after the carnage of World War II, notwithstanding the shadow of the Iron Curtain. Europe's security and prosperity contributed to our security and prosperity. Support of Ukraine's success also fits squarely into our strategy for Central and Eastern Europe since the fall of the wall 30 years ago this past week. A Europe truly whole, free, and at peace, our strategic aim for the entirety of my Foreign Service career, is not possible without a Ukraine whole, free, and at peace, including Crimea and the Donbass, territories currently occupied by Russia.
I'm not even sure how much of this is even relevant to the actual.
Looking forward, the Trump administration's national security strategy.
But this is why he's
makes
here.
Clear
probably.
The global strategic
now,
challenge.
And I think people also have to appreciate
great power competition
that a guy like this
and China,
is,
and
you know,
need to compete for positive
one or two generations out from diplomats who.
In that sense, Ukraine has been on the front lines, not just of Russia's
whose primary objective was to avoid another world war.
And its broader campaign,
you know,
of
who had first and direct knowledge of
now facing
World
United
War II.
States.
And
Ukraine's popular revolution of dignity
stability was the first thing. Then the second thing was American hegemony.
Russian leadership
and maybe American hegemony first and then stability. But the stability was quite key to American hegemony. So
equivalent to the size of Texas for the United States. At that time, Ukraine's state institutions were on the verge of collapse. Ukrainian civil society answered the challenge. They formed volunteer battalions of citizens, including technology professionals and medics. They crowdsourced funding for their own weapons, body armor, and supplies. They were the 21st century Ukrainian equivalent of our own Minutemen of 1776, buying time for a regular army to reconstitute. Since then, more than 13,000 Ukrainians have died on Ukrainian soil defending their territorial integrity and sovereignty from Russian aggression. America's support in Ukraine's own de facto war of independence has been critical in this regard. By analogy, the American colonies may not have prevailed against the British imperial might without the help of transatlantic friends after 1776. In an echo of Lafayette's organized assistance to General George Washington's army and Admiral John Paul Jones's navy, Congress has generously appropriated over $1.5 billion over the past 5 years in desperately needed trained and equipped security assistance to Ukraine. These funds increase Ukraine's strength and ability to fight Russian aggression. Ultimately, Ukraine is on a path to become a full security partner of the United States within NATO. Similar to von Steuben training colonials at Valley Forge, U.S. and NATO allied trainers developed the skills of Ukrainian units at Yavoriv near the Polish
the
border
that he
and elsewhere.
Tell on the sexual
they helped
predator.
Rewrite military education for Ukraine's next
I'm looking for a glossary
generation,
of wrestling terms
as von Steuben
to
did
a
for America's
for him,
first.
But they all, it does
and supporting
pro-wrestling,
Ukraine's brave resistance to Russian aggression, we have a front row seat to the Russian way of war in the 21st century, gaining priceless insights that contribute to our own security.
This stuff is
this year in 2019,
largely irrelevant in my mind. I mean, it's nice to know, I guess, his perspective on this, but this is
not in the final years of the Soviet Union, but in an independent Ukraine. Presidential and
Ukraine,
parliamentary elections swept out much.
People
of
could have a completely opposite opinion of our relationship
President
with Ukraine.
Zelensky, a cabinet with an average age of 39,
and
a parliament with the average age of
41. It would have no material difference on why he's there to testify.
Mandate,
and so this, I think, is
Ukraine's revolution of dignity, is a thirst for justice.
Is a waste.
Because there cannot be dignity without justice. Without a reformed judicial sector that delivers justice with integrity for all, Ukrainian
George
society
Kent
will
has
remain
made this
unsettled.
Into
foreign investors, including American investors, will not bring the great investment needed.
The George Kent. This is my opportunity to get my memoir. I'm
CV
getting
CV review.
This exactly. is why the principled promotion of the rule of law and institutional integrity is so necessary to our strategy for a successful Ukraine. It is also true for other former captive nations still recovering from the ashes of Soviet and communist misrule. It is why acting inconsistently with the core principle of the rule of law comes at great peril. I am grateful to all of the members of Congress and staffers, including many of you sitting here today, who have traveled to Ukraine over the past 5 years and appropriated billions of dollars of assistance in support of our primary policy goals. Those funds increase Ukraine's ability to fight Russian aggression in the defense, energy, cyber, and information spheres, and they also empower state institutions and civil society to undertake systemic reforms and tackle corruption. I believe all of us can be proud of our efforts in Ukraine over the past 5 years, even though much remains to be done. And by all of us, I mean those of us in the legislative and the executive branches, in both parties, the interagency community working out of our embassy in Kyiv, with Ukrainians in government, the military and civil society, and our transatlantic allies and partners. We cannot allow our resolve to waver, since too much is at stake, not just for Ukraine and the future of European security, but for the national interests of the United States, broadly defined. My prior deposition covered a lot of ground over 10 hours. Here are the main 10 themes for my testimony. I outlined my experience with longstanding U.S. interest in supporting anti-corruption efforts in Ukraine. This work gave me a front-row seat to problematic activities by successive prosecutors general in Ukraine. For many of the issues this committee is investigating, my knowledge and understanding is sometimes firsthand and sometimes comes from others involved in specific conversations and meetings. This is no different than how anyone learns and carries out his or her job responsibilities. I have been and remain willing to share my factual observations with the committee and will make clear when those are based on personal knowledge or from information gleaned from others. U.S. efforts to counter corruption in Ukraine focus on building institutional capacity so that the Ukrainian government has the ability to go after corruption and effectively investigate, prosecute, and judge alleged criminal activities using appropriate institutional mechanisms. That is, to create and follow the rule of law. That means that if there are criminal nexuses for activity in the United States, U.S. law enforcement should pursue the case. If we think there's been a criminal act overseas that violates U.S. law, we have the institutional mechanisms to address that. It could be through the Justice Department and FBI agents assigned overseas, or through treaty mechanisms, such as the Mutual Legal Assistance Treaty. As a general principle, I do not believe the United States should ask other countries to engage in selective, politically associated investigations or prosecutions against opponents of those in power, because such selective actions undermine the rule of law, regardless of the country. The pervasive and longstanding problem of corruption in Ukraine included exposure to a situation involving the energy company Burisma. The primary concern of the U.S. government since 2014 was Burisma's owner, Mykola Zlochevsky, whose frozen assets abroad we had attempted to recover on Ukraine's behalf. In early 2015, I raised questions with the Deputy Prosecutor General about why the investigation of Mr. Zlochevsky had been terminated, based on our belief that prosecutors had accepted bribes to close the case.
This is relevant stuff as to
later,
what...
I became aware that Hunter Biden was on the board of Burisma. Soon after that, in a briefing call with the National Security Staff of the Office of the Vice President in February of 2015, I raised my concern that Hunter Biden's status as a board member could create the perception of a conflict of interest. Let me be clear, however, I did not witness any effort by any U.S. official to shield Burisma from scrutiny. In fact, I and other U.S. officials consistently advocated reinstituting a scuttled investigation of Zlochevsky, Burisma's founder, as well as holding the corrupt prosecutors who closed the case to account. Over the course of 2018 and 2019, I became increasingly aware of an effort by Rudy Giuliani and others, including his associates Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman, to run a campaign to smear Ambassador Yovanovitch and other officials at the U.S. Embassy in Kyiv. The chief agitators on the Ukrainian side of this effort were some of those same corrupt former prosecutors I had encountered, particularly Yuri Lutsenko and Viktor Shokin. They were now peddling false information in order to extract revenge against those who had exposed their misconduct, including U.S. diplomats, Ukrainian anti-corruption officials, and reform-minded civil society groups in Ukraine. During the late spring and summer of 2019, I became alarmed as those efforts bore fruit. They led to the ouster of Ambassador Yovanovitch and hampered U.S. efforts to establish rapport with the new Zelensky administration in Ukraine. In mid-August, it became clear to me that Giuliani's efforts to gin up politically motivated investigations were now infecting U.S. engagement with Ukraine, leveraging President Zelensky's desire for a White House meeting. There are and always have been conditionality placed on our sovereign loan guarantees for Ukraine. Conditions include anti-corruption reforms, as well as meeting larger stability goals and social safety nets. The International Monetary Fund does the same thing. Congress and the executive branch work together to put conditionality on some security assistance in the Ukraine Security Assistance Initiative. Regarding my testimony today, I will do my best to answer your questions, questions that will involve issues,
okay,
conversations, and documents that span a number of years.
That 1048
I may be limited
to
by three considerations. First, the State Department has collected all materials in response to the September 27th subpoena that may contain facts relevant to my testimony. I have no such documents or materials with me today. I will thus do my best to answer as accurately, completely, and truthfully as I can to the best of my recollection. Second, as this committee knows from deposition testimony, throughout this process there have been concerns that questions may be asked about classified information. We have asked the State Department for guidance about classification concerns related to the public release of my deposition, and the State Department has declined to provide any.
Wow.
So if I'm asked a question today that I believe may implicate classified information, I will respectfully decline to answer in this public forum. Third, there may be questions focusing on the identity of people in the intelligence community. These questions were redacted from my deposition's transcript. If such a question arises today, I will follow my counsel's advice and decline to answer.
Okay, so
I would like to conclude my opening remarks with an observation about some of my fellow public servants who have come under personal attacks: Ambassador Yovanovitch, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, and Dr. Hill, at least one of whom is going to appear before this body in the coming days. Masha, Alex, and Fiona were born abroad before their families or they themselves personally chose to immigrate to the United States. They all made the professional choice to serve the United States as public officials.
You get the sense this guy knows which boats.
Helping shape our national security policy towards Russia in particular. And we and our national security are the better for it. In this sense, they are the 21st century heirs of two giants of 20th century U.S. national security policy who also were born abroad. My former professor is Zbigniew Brzezinski and his fellow immigrant Henry Kissinger. Like the Brzezinskis and Kissingers, the Yovanovitches and Vindmans fled Nazi and communist oppression to contribute to a stronger, more secure America. That honorable tradition
Kissinger also went on to be a bit of a war criminal, but
goes back to the very founding of our republic.
Let's not.
Our 18th century independence would not have been secured.
All right, put this down because the really important parts of this were in the last 2 minutes of his statement about 4 or 5 minutes ago, where he outlined the dynamic that was taking place when Joe Biden came over and said, "You've got to help out with this investigation of Burisma with the British government." And the diplomatic corps' response to having Hunter Biden there. And then he talks about what happened subsequent to that. Then he also talked about the fact that the State Department has not provided him any guidance whatsoever in terms of what to say or not to say, which is problematic, at least in terms of like what is classified and what is not. Let's listen to Ambassador Bill Taylor.
Impeachment proceedings. I am not here to take one side or the other, or to advocate for any particular outcome of these proceedings. My sole purpose is to provide facts as I know them about the incidents in question, as well as my views about the strategic importance of Ukraine to the United States. By way of background, it has been a privilege for me to serve our country and the American people for more than 50 years, starting as a cadet at West Point, as you have mentioned, Mr. Chairman, then as an infantry officer for 6 years, including with the 101st Airborne Division in Vietnam, then at the Department of Energy, then as a member of a Senate staff, then at NATO, then with the State Department here and abroad in Afghanistan, Iraq, Jerusalem, and Ukraine. I retired from the State Department in 2009 to join the United States Institute of Peace. I'm neither a career member of the Foreign Service nor of the Civil Service. I am nonpartisan and have been appointed to my positions by every president from President Reagan to President Trump. Let me summarize my main points. First, Ukraine is a strategic partner of the United States, important for the security of our country, as well as Europe. Ukraine is on the front line in the conflict with a newly aggressive Russia. Second, even as we sit here today, the Russians are attacking Ukrainian soldiers in their own country and have been for the last 4 years. I saw this on the front line last week. The day I was there, a Ukrainian soldier was killed and 4 were wounded. Third, the security assistance we provide is crucial to Ukraine's defense and to the protection of the soldiers I met on the front line last week. It demonstrates to Ukrainians and Russians that we are Ukraine's reliable strategic partner. It is clearly in our national interest to deter further Russian aggression. And finally, as the committee is aware, I wrote that withholding security assistance in exchange for help with a domestic political campaign in the United States would be crazy. I believed that then, and I believe it now. Let me tell you why. On May 28th of this year, I met with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who asked me to rejoin the State Department and return to Kyiv to lead our embassy in Ukraine. It was and is a critical time for U.S.-Ukraine relations. I had served as ambassador to Ukraine from 2006 to 2009, having been nominated by George W. Bush, and in the intervening 10 years had stayed engaged with Ukraine. Across the responsibilities I have had in public service, Ukraine is the highlight. And so Secretary Pompeo's offer to return as chief of mission was compelling. Since I left Ukraine in 2009, the country had continued to turn toward the West. But in 2013, Vladimir Putin was so threatened by the prospect of Ukraine joining the European Union that he tried to bribe the Ukrainian president. This triggered mass protests in the winter of 2013 that drove that president to flee to Russia in February 2014, but not before his forces killed 100 Ukrainian protesters in central Kyiv. Days later, Mr. Putin invaded Crimea, holding a sham referendum at the point of Russian army rifles. The Russians absurdly claimed that 97% voted to join Russia. In early April, Putin sent his army and security forces into southeastern Ukraine to generate illegal armed formations and puppet governments in what we know as Donbas. You can see this on the map in the right-hand portion, in the eastern portion of the country. 14,000 Ukrainians have died in the war in Donbas, like that, and more die each week. In July 2014, these Russian-led forces in Donbas shot down a civilian airliner en route from Amsterdam to Malaysia, killing all 298 people on board. We, the Europeans, and most of the West impose economic sanctions and kick the Russians out of the G8. Beginning in 2014, we and NATO began to provide military assistance to Ukraine's armed forces in the form of training, advice, military equipment, and weapons. It is this security assistance that is at the heart of the controversy that we are discussing today. The pro-Russian president, who was run out of Kyiv in 2014, had let the Russian armed forces deteriorate to the point of ruin. In response to the Russian invasion, the new Ukrainian authorities, with an amazing outpouring of support from regular Ukrainian people, rebuilt the army nearly from scratch, spending more than 5% of Ukrainian GDP on defense since the war started. The whole Ukrainian nation fiercely responded to the Russian attack. The nation united like never before. A ragtag army developed into a strong fighting force, and the United States played a vital role. Since 2014, You and Congress have provided over $1.6 billion in military assistance to Ukraine. The security assistance provides small unit training at an army base near Lviv in the western of the country. It provides ambulances, night vision devices, communications equipment, counter-battery radar, Navy ships, and finally, weapons. This security assistance demonstrates our commitment to resist aggression and defend freedom. During the 2014 to 2016 period, I was serving outside of government and joined two other former ambassadors to Ukraine in urging the Obama administration officials at the State Department, Defense Department, and other agencies to provide lethal defensive weapons to Ukraine in order to deter further Russian aggression. I also supported much stronger sanctions on Russia. I was pleased when the Trump administration provided Javelin anti-tank missiles and enacted stronger sanctions. All to say, I cared about Ukraine's future and the important U.S. interests there. So when Secretary Pompeo asked me to go back to Kyiv, I wanted to say yes, but it was not an easy decision. The former ambassador, Masha Yovanovitch, has been treated poorly, caught in a web of political machinations both in Kyiv and in Washington. I feared that those problems were still present. I consulted both my wife and a respected former senior Republican official who has been a mentor. I will tell you that my wife, in no uncertain terms, strongly opposed the idea. The mentor counseled, if your country asks you to do something, you do it.
When are the Republicans going to subpoena her?
I could be effective only if the U.S. policy of strong support for Ukraine, strong diplomatic support, along with robust security, economic, and technical assistance were to continue. And if I had the backing of the Secretary of State to implement that policy. And I worried about what I had heard concerning the role of Rudy Giuliani, who had made several controversial statements about Ukraine and U.S. policy toward the country. So during my meeting with Secretary Pompeo on May 28th, I made clear to him and the others present that if U.S. policy toward Ukraine changed, he would not want me posted there, and I could not stay. He assured me that the policy of strong support for Ukraine would continue and that he would support me in defending that policy. With that understanding, I agreed to go back to Kyiv. Because I was appointed by the Secretary,
that's
but not
pretty relevant
reconfirmed by the
insofar
Senate. My
as
official position was chargé
d'affaires ad interim.
In effect, I was the acting
Ukraine
ambassador to Ukraine.
Was.
I returned to Kyiv on June 17th,
we're getting splitting hairs
carrying the original
here,
copy
but, you know,
of a letter President Trump signed the day after
this.
I met with the Secretary. In that letter, President Trump congratulated
Trump
President
could have
Zelensky
theoretically changed
on
the foreign policy
victory
to Ukraine,
and invited
but he
him to a meeting
he didn't
in
care
the
about
office.
That. He cared only about getting
Once
his goodies.
Once I arrived in Kyiv, I discovered a weird combination of encouraging, confusing, and ultimately alarming circumstances. First, the encouraging. President Zelensky was reforming Ukraine in a hurry. He appointed reformist ministers and supported long-stalled anti-corruption legislation. He took quick executive action, including opening Ukraine's high anti-corruption court. With a new parliamentary majority stemming from snap elections, President Zelensky changed the Ukrainian constitution to remove absolute immunity from Rada deputies, the source of raw corruption for two decades. The excitement in Kyiv was palpable. This time could be different, a new Ukraine finally breaking from its corrupt post-Soviet past. And yet, I found a confusing and unusual arrangement for making U.S. policy toward Ukraine. There appeared to be two channels of U.S. policymaking and implementation,
Note
one
this.
Regular and one highly irregular. As the acting ambassador, I had authority over the regular, formal diplomatic processes, including the bulk of the U.S. effort to support Ukraine against Russian invasion and to help it defeat corruption.
Two-track. Two-track.
My colleague, Deputy Assistant Secretary of State George Kent, and our colleagues at the National Security Council were my main points of contact in Washington in this regular channel. This channel is formally responsible for formulating and overseeing the implementation of U.S. foreign policy with respect to Ukraine, a policy that has consistently enjoyed strong bipartisan support, both in Congress and in all administrations since Ukraine's independence from Russia in 1991. At the same time, however, I encountered an irregular, informal channel of U.S. policymaking with respect to Ukraine, unaccountable to Congress, a channel that included then Special Envoy Kurt Volker, U.S. Ambassador to the European Union Gordon Sondland, Secretary of Energy Rick Perry, White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney, and, as I subsequently learned, Mr. Giuliani. I was clearly in the regular channel, but I was also in the irregular one to the extent that Ambassadors Volker and Sondland, including me, in certain conversations.
Who let Serpico
Although
in?
Although this irregular channel was well-connected in Washington, it operated mostly outside of official State Department channels. The irregular channel began when Ambassador Volker, Ambassador Sondland, Secretary Perry, and Senator Ron Johnson briefed President Trump on May 23rd upon their return from President Zelensky's inauguration. The delegation was as enthusiastic as I would soon become about the new Ukrainian president and urged President Trump to meet with him early on to cement the U.S.-Ukraine relationship. But from what I understood from the participants, President Trump did not share their enthusiasm for a meeting with President Zelensky. When I arrived in Kyiv, the actions of both the regular and the irregular channels of foreign policy appeared to serve the same goal, a strong U.S.-Ukraine partnership. But it became clear to me by August that the channels had diverged in their objectives. As this occurred, I became increasingly concerned.
That's weird. We planned it. Channel
in late June,
divergence.
Both channels were trying to facilitate
classic,
a visit
classic
of President Zelensky to the White
diplomatic
House
move.
For a meeting with President Trump, which President Trump had promised in his congratulatory letter of May 29th. The Ukrainians were clearly eager for the meeting to happen. But during my subsequent communications with Ambassadors Volker and Sondland, they relayed to me that the president wanted to hear from Zelensky before scheduling the meeting in the Oval Office.
Just want to hear his voice.
It was not clear to me
just to make sure. Got to look it in his eyes to see if he's a good guy.
June 27th, Ambassador Sondland told me during a phone conversation that President Zelensky needed to make clear to President Trump that he, President Zelensky, was not standing in the way of investigations. I sensed something odd when Ambassador Sondland told me on June 28th that he did not wish to include most of the regular interagency participants in a call planned with President Zelensky later that day. Ambassador Sondland, Ambassador Volker, Secretary Perry, and I were on this call, dialing in from different locations. However, Ambassador Sondland said he wanted to make sure no one was transcribing or monitoring as they added President Zelensky to the call. Also, before President Zelensky joined the call, Ambassador Volker separately told the U.S. participants that he, Ambassador Volker, planned to be explicit with President Zelensky in a one-on-one meeting in Toronto on July 2nd. In that meeting, Ambassador Volker planned to make clear what President Zelensky should do to get the White House meeting. I did not understand what this meant, but Ambassador Volker said he would relay that President Trump wanted to see rule of law, transparency, but also specifically cooperation on investigations to get to the bottom of things. Once President Zelensky joined the call, the conversation was focused on energy policy and the war in Donbass. President Zelensky also said he looked forward to the White House visit President Trump had offered in his May 29th letter. By mid-July, it was becoming clear to me that the meeting President Zelensky wanted was conditioned on the investigations of Burisma and alleged Ukrainian interference in the 2016 U.S. elections. It was also clear that this condition was driven by the irregular policy channel I had come to understand was guided by Mr. Giuliani. In a regular NSC secure video conference call on July 18th, I heard a staff person from the Office of Management and Budget say that there was a hold on security assistance to Ukraine, but could not say why. Toward the end of an otherwise normal meeting, a voice on the call, the person was off screen, said that she was from OMB and her boss had instructed her not to approve any additional spending on security assistance for Ukraine until further notice. I and others sat in astonishment. The Ukrainians were fighting Russians and counted on not only the training and weapons, but also the assurance of U.S. support. All that the OMB staff person said was that the directive had come from the president to the chief of staff to OMB. In an instant, I realized that one of the key pillars of our strong support for Ukraine was threatened. The irregular policy channel was running contrary to the goals of longstanding U.S. policy.
The chief of staff and the
there followed
acting
a series
director
of NSC-led interagency
person,
meetings, starting
believe,
at the staff level and quickly reaching the level of cabinet secretaries. At every meeting, the unanimous conclusion was that the security assistance should be resumed, the hold lifted. At one point, the Defense Department was asked to perform an analysis of the effectiveness of the assistance. Within a day, the Defense Department came back with the determination that the assistance was effective and should be resumed. My understanding was that the Secretaries of Defense and State, the CIA Director, and the National Security Advisor sought a joint meeting with the President to convince him to release the hold, but such a meeting was hard to schedule, and the hold lasted well into September. On July 9th, in a phone call with then-Senior Director for European and Russian Affairs Fiona Hill and Director of European Affairs Lieutenant Colonel Alex Vindman at the NSC, they tried to assure me that they were not aware of any official change in U.S. policy towards Ukraine, OMB's announcement notwithstanding. They did confirm that the hold on security assistance for Ukraine came from Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney, who maintained a skeptical view of Ukraine. In the same July 19th phone call, they gave me an account of a July 10th meeting with Ukrainian and American officials at the White House. They told me that partway through the meeting, Ambassador Sondland had connected investigations with an Oval Office meeting for President Zelensky, which so irritated then National Security Advisor John Bolton that he abruptly ended the meeting, telling Dr. Hill and Lieutenant Colonel Vindman that they should have nothing to do with domestic politics. He also directed Dr. Hill to brief the lawyers. Dr. Hill said that Ambassador Bolton referred to this deal as a drug deal. After the July 10th meeting, Ambassador Bolton opposed a call between President Zelensky and President Trump out of concern that it would be a disaster. Needless to say, the Ukrainians in the meetings were confused. Ambassador Bolton, in the regular Ukraine policy decision-making channel, wanted to talk about security, energy, and reform. Ambassador Sondland, a participant in the irregular channel, wanted to talk about the connection between a White House meeting and Ukrainian investigations. Also, during our July 19th call, Dr. Hill informed me that Ambassador Volker had met with Mr. Giuliani to discuss Ukraine. This caught me by surprise. The next day, I asked Ambassador Volker about that meeting, but received no response. I began to sense that these two separate decision-making channels, the regular and the irregular, were separate and at odds. Later that day, I received text messages on a three-way WhatsApp text conversation with Ambassadors Volker and Sondland, a record of which was provided by Ambassador Volker. Ambassador Sondland said that a call between President Trump and President Zelensky would take place soon. Ambassador Volker said that what was most important is for Zelensky to say that he will help investigation and address any specific personnel issues, if there are any. On the next day, July 20th, I had a phone conversation with Ambassador Sondland while he was on a train from Paris to London. Ambassador Sondland told me that he had recommended to President Zelensky that he use the phrase, "I will leave no stone unturned," with regard to investigations when President Zelensky spoke with President Trump. Also, on July 20th, I had a phone conversation with Alexander Danyluk, President Zelensky's national security advisor, who emphasized that President Zelensky did not want to be used as an instrument in a U.S. re-election campaign.
Oh, yes, he did.
The next day, I texted both Ambassadors Volker and Sondland about President Zelensky's concern. On July 25th, President Trump and President Zelensky had the long-awaited phone conversation. Even though I was acting ambassador and was scheduled to meet with President Zelensky along with Ambassador Volker the following day, I received no readout of the call from the White House. The Ukrainian government issued a short, cryptic summary. During a previously planned July 26 meeting, President Zelensky told Ambassador Volker and me that he was happy with the call, but did not elaborate. President Zelensky then asked about the face-to-face meeting in the Oval Office as promised in the May 29th letter from President Trump. We could give him no firm answer. After our meeting with President Zelensky, Ambassador Volker and I traveled to the front line in northern Donbas to receive a briefing from the commander of forces on the line of contact. Arriving for the briefing in the military headquarters, the commander thanked us for the security assistance. But I was aware that this assistance was on hold, which made me uncomfortable. Ambassador Volker and I could see the armed and hostile Russian-led forces on the other side of the damaged bridge across the line of contact. Russian-led forces continue to kill Ukrainians in the war one or two a week. More Ukrainians would undoubtedly die without the U.S. assistance. Although I spent the morning of July 26 with President Zelensky and other Ukrainian officials, the first summary of the July 25th Trump-Zelensky call that I heard from anybody inside the U.S. government was during a phone call I had with Tim Morrison, Dr. Hill's recent replacement at the NSC, on July 28th. Mr. Morrison told me that the call could have been better and that President Trump had suggested that President Zelensky or his staff meet with Mr. Giuliani and President and Attorney General William Barr. I did not see any official readout of the call until it was publicly released on September 25th. By August, I was becoming more concerned. On August 16th, I exchanged text messages with Ambassador Volker in which I learned that Andriy Yermak, a senior advisor to President Zelensky, had asked that the United States submit an official request for an investigation into Burisma's alleged violations of Ukrainian law, if that is what the United States desired. A formal U.S. request to the Ukrainians to conduct an investigation based on violations of their own law struck me as improper, and I recommended to Ambassador Volker that we stay clear. To find out the legal aspects of the question, however, I gave him the name of a Deputy Assistant Attorney General whom I thought would be the proper point of contact for seeking a U.S. request for a foreign investigation. By mid-August, because the security assistance had been held for over a month for no reason that I could discern, I was beginning to fear that the long-standing U.S. policy of support for Ukraine was shifting. I called State Department Counselor Ulrich Brechbuhl to discuss this on August 21st. He said he was not aware of a change in policy, but would check on the status of the security assistance. My concern deepened the next day on August 22nd during a phone conversation with Mr. Morrison. I asked him if there had been a change in policy of strong support for Ukraine, to which he responded, "It remains to be seen." He also told me during this call that the president doesn't want to provide any assistance at all. That was extremely troubling to me. As I had told Secretary Pompeo in May, if the policy of strong support for Ukraine were to change, I would have to resign. Based on my call with Mr. Morrison, I was preparing to do so. Just days later, on August 27th, Ambassador Bolton arrived in Kyiv and met with President Zelensky. During their meeting, security assistance was not discussed. As far as I knew, the Ukrainians were not aware of the hold until August 29th. I, on the other hand, was all too aware of and still troubled by the hold. Near the end of Ambassador Bolton's visit, I asked to meet him privately, during which I expressed to him my serious concern about the withholding of military assistance to Ukraine while the Ukrainians were defending their country from Russian aggression. Ambassador Bolton recommended that I send a first-person cable to Secretary Pompeo directly, relaying my concerns. I wrote and transmitted such a cable on August 29th, describing the folly I saw in withholding military aid to Ukraine at a time when hostilities were still active in the East and when Russia was watching closely to gauge the level of American support for the Ukrainian government. The Russians, as I said at my deposition, would love to see the humiliation of President Zelensky at the hands of the Americans. I told the Secretary that I could not and would not defend such a policy. Although I received no specific response, I heard that soon thereafter, the Secretary carried the cable with him to a meeting at the White House focused on security assistance for Ukraine. The same day that I sent my cable to the Secretary, Mr. Yermak contacted me very concerned, asking about the withheld security assistance. The hold that the White House had placed on assistance had just been made public that day in a Politico story. At that point, I was embarrassed that I could give him no explanation for why it was withheld. It had still not occurred to me that the hold on security assistance could be related to the investigations. That, however, would change. On September 1st, just 3 days after my cable to Secretary Pompeo, President Zelensky met Vice President Pence at a bilateral meeting in Warsaw. President Trump had planned to travel to Warsaw, but at the last minute had canceled because of Hurricane Dorian. Just hours before the Pence-Zelensky meeting, I contacted Mr. Danieluk to let him know that the delay of U.S. assistance was an all-or-nothing proposition in the sense that if the White House did not lift the hold prior to the end of the fiscal year, September 30th, the funds would expire and Ukraine would receive nothing. I was hopeful that at the bilateral meeting, or shortly thereafter, the White House would lift the hold, but this was not to be. On the evening of September 1st, I received a readout of the Pence-Zelensky meeting over the phone from Mr. Morrison, during which he told me that President Zelensky had opened the meeting by immediately asking Vice President about the security cooperation. The Vice President did not respond substantively, but said that he would talk to President Trump that night. The Vice President did say that President Trump wanted the Europeans to do more to support Ukraine and that he wanted the Ukrainians to do more to fight corruption. During the same phone call with Mr. Morrison, he described a conversation Ambassador Sondland had with Mr. Yermak in Warsaw. Ambassador Sondland told Mr. Yermak that the security assistance money would not come until President Zelensky committed to pursue the Burisma investigation. I was alarmed by what Mr. Morrison told me about the Sondland-Yermak conversation. I understand that Mr. Morrison testified at his deposition that Ambassador Sondland proposed it might be sufficient for the Ukrainian prosecutor general to commit to pursue the investigations, as opposed to President Zelensky. But this was the first time that I had heard that the security assistance, not just the White House meeting, was conditioned on the investigations. Very concerned, on that same day, September 1st, I sent Ambassador Sondland a text message asking if we are now saying that the security assistance and a White House meeting are conditioned on investigations. Ambassador Sondland responded, asking me to call him, which I did. During that phone call, Ambassador Sondland told me that President Trump had told him that he wants President Zelensky to state publicly that Ukraine will investigate Burisma and alleged Ukrainian interference in the 2016 election. Ambassador Sondland also told me that he now recognized that he had made a mistake by earlier telling Ukrainian officials that only a White House meeting with President Zelensky was dependent on a public announcement of the investigations. In fact, Ambassador Sondland said, everything was dependent on such an announcement, including security assistance. He said that President Trump wanted President Zelensky in a public box by making a public statement about ordering such investigations.
That moment right there,
September 1st,
is going to make it very hard to pin this all on Giuliani. Because why is Sondland going directly to the president and saying this?
For another head of state, and that what he described was not in the interest of either President Trump or President Zelensky. At that point, I asked Ambassador Sondland to push back on President Trump's demand. Ambassador Sondland pledged to try. I suggested the possibility that Ukrainian prosecutor general, rather than President Zelensky, would make a statement about the investigations, potentially in coordination with Attorney General Barr's probe into the investigation of interference in the 2016 elections. The next day, September 2nd, Mr. Morrison called to inform me that Mr. Danieluk had asked him to come to his hotel in Warsaw. Mr. Danieluk expressed President Zelensky's concern about the possible loss of U.S. support for Ukraine. In particular, Mr. Morrison relayed to me that the inability of any U.S. officials to respond to the Ukrainians' explicit questions about security assistance was troubling them. I was experiencing the same tension in my dealings with the Ukrainians, including a meeting I had had with the defense minister that day. On September 5th, I accompanied Senators Johnson and Murphy during their visit to Kyiv. When we met with President Zelensky, his first question to the senators was about the withheld security assistance. My recollection of the meeting is that both senators stressed that bipartisan support for Ukraine in Washington was Ukraine's most important strategic asset, and that President Zelensky should not jeopardize that bipartisan support by getting drawn in to U.S. domestic politics. I had been making and continue to make this point to all of my official Ukrainian contacts, but the odd push to make President Zelensky publicly commit to investigations of Burisma and alleged interference in the 2016 election showed how the official foreign policy of the United States was undercut by the irregular efforts led by Mr. Giuliani. 2 days later, September 7th, I had a conversation with Mr. Morrison in which he described a phone conversation earlier that day between Ambassador Sondland and President Trump. Mr. Morrison said that he had a sinking feeling after learning about this conversation from Ambassador Sondland. According to Mr. Morrison, President Trump told Ambassador Sondland he was not asking for a quid pro quo. But President Trump did insist that President Zelensky go to a microphone and say he is opening investigations of Biden and 2016 election interference.
It's not a quid pro quo. It's
and
a this
President
for that.
President Zelensky should want to do this himself. Mr. Morrison said that he told Ambassador Bolton and the NSC lawyers of this phone call between President Trump and Ambassador Sondland. The following day, on September 8th, Ambassador Sondland and I spoke on the phone. He confirmed that he had talked to President Trump, as I had suggested a week earlier, but that President Trump was adamant that President Zelensky himself had to clear things up and do it in public. President Trump said it was not a quid pro quo. I believe this was the same conversation between Ambassador Sondland and President Trump that Mr. Morrison had described to me on September 7th. Ambassador Sondland also said that he had talked to President Zelensky and Mr. Yermak and had told them that although this was not a quid pro quo, if President Zelensky did not clear things up in public, we would be at a stalemate.
Look, this is not a quid pro quo. You just got
to
do this for that.
You haven't played chess. Much needed military assistance. Ambassador Sondland said that this conversation concluded with President Zelensky agreeing to make a public statement in an interview on CNN. Shortly after that call with Ambassador Sondland, I expressed my strong reservations in a text message to Ambassador Sondland, stating that my nightmare is that they, the Ukrainians, give the interview and don't get the security assistance. The Russians love it, and I quit. And I was serious. The next day, September 9th, I said to Ambassador Sondland Volker that the message to the Ukrainians and the Russians we send with the decision on security assistance is key. With the hold, we have already shaken their faith in us. I also said, I think it's crazy to withhold security assistance for help with the political campaign.
Well, I'll show you crazy.
Sondland responded about 5 hours later that I was incorrect about President Trump's intentions. The president has been crystal clear, no quid pro quos of any kind. During our call on September 8th, Ambassador Sondland tried to explain to me that President Trump is a businessman. When a businessman is about to sign a check to someone who owes him something, the businessman asks that person to pay up before signing
right?
the check. Ambassador Volker used the same language several days later while we were together at the Yalta European Strategy Conference. I argued to both that the explanation made no sense. Ukrainians did not owe President Trump anything. And holding up security assistance for domestic political gain was crazy, as I had said in my text message to Ambassador Sondland and Volker on September 9th. Finally, on September 11th, I learned that the hold had been lifted and security assistance would be provided. I was not told the reason why the hold had been lifted. The next day, I personally conveyed the news to President Zelensky and the Ukrainian foreign minister, and I again reminded Mr. Yermak of the high strategic value of bipartisan support for Ukraine, and the importance of not getting involved in other countries' elections. My fear at the time was that since Ambassador Sondland had told me President Zelensky had already agreed to do a CNN interview, President Zelensky would make a statement regarding investigations that would have played into domestic U.S. politics. I sought to confirm through Mr. Donnelly.
Oh, yeah, we are still here. Give us 1 second.
Back up.
Confirmed that on September 12th, I noticed during a meeting on the morning of September 13th at President Zelensky's office that Mr. Yermak looked uncomfortable in response to the question. Again, I asked Mr. Danyluk to confirm that there would be no CNN interview, which he did. On September 25th, at the UN General Assembly session in New York City, President Trump met President Zelensky face-to-face. He also released the transcript of the July 25th call. The United States gave the Ukrainians virtually no notice of the release, and they were livid. Although this was the first time I had seen the details of President Trump's July 25th call with President Zelensky, in which he mentioned Vice President Biden, I had come to understand well before then that investigations was a term Ambassadors Volker and Sondland used to mean matters related to the 2016 elections and to investigations of Burisma and the Bidens. Last Friday, a member of my staff told me of events that occurred on July 26th.
This is new, folks.
While Ambassador Volker and I visited the front, this member of my staff accompanied Ambassador Sondland. Ambassador Sondland met with Mr. Yermak. Following that meeting, in the presence of my staff, at a restaurant, Ambassador Sondland called President Trump and told him of his meetings in Kyiv. The member of my staff could hear President Trump on the phone asking Ambassador Sondland about the investigations. Ambassador Sondland told President Trump the Ukrainians were ready to move forward. Following the call with President Trump, the member of my staff asked Ambassador Sondland what President Trump thought about Ukraine. Ambassador Sondland responded that President Trump cares more about the investigations of Biden, which Giuliani was pressing for. At the time I gave my deposition on October 22nd, I was not aware of this information. I am including it here for completeness. As the committee knows, I reported this information through counsel to the State Department's legal advisor, as well as to counsel for both the majority and the minority of this committee.
Nunes,
it is my understanding that the committee is following up on this matter. Mr. Chairman, I recognize that this is rather a lengthy recitation of the events of the past few months, told from my vantage point in Kyiv. But I also recognize the importance of the matters your committee is investigating. And I hope that this chronology will provide some framework for your questions. As I mentioned in my October 22nd deposition, the information and quotes in my testimony are based on my best recollection as well as a review of
folks,
my personal
notes. Folks, that last
notes.
Part is pretty big.
Let me return to the points I made at the outset. Ukraine is important to the security of the United States. The largest country in Europe by landmass, Ukraine is a young democracy struggling to join Europe and ally itself with the United States. It has been violently attacked by Russia, which continues its armed aggression against Ukraine to this day. If we believe in the principle of the sovereignty of nations, on which our security and the security of our friends and allies depends, if we believe that nations get to decide on their own economic, political, and security alliances, we must support Ukraine in its fight against its bullying neighbor. Russian aggression cannot stand. Republican and Democratic administrations over three decades have been generous with assistance funding, both civilian and military, and political support. With overwhelming bipartisan majorities, Congress has imposed harsh sanctions on Russia for invading and occupying Ukraine. Mr. Chairman, there are two Ukraine stories today. The first is the one we're discussing this morning that you have been hearing about for the past 2 weeks. It's a rancorous story about whistleblowers, Mr. Giuliani, side channels, quid pro quos, corruption, and interference in elections. In this story, Ukraine is merely an object. But there's another story, a positive, bipartisan one. In this second story, Ukraine is the subject. This one is about young people in a young nation struggling to break free of its past, hopeful that their new government will finally usher in a new Ukraine, proud of its independence from Russia, eager to join Western institutions and enjoy a more secure and prosperous life. This story describes a nation developing an inclusive democratic nationalism, not unlike what we in America, in our best moments, feel about our diverse country. Less concerned about what language we speak, what religion, if any, we practice, where our parents and grandparents came from, more concerned about building a new country.
Stephen Miller may take issue with that, but
I thank you both for your testimony, and I now recognize myself and Majority Counsel for 45 minutes of questions.
Mr. Chairman,
Ambassador Taylor, I would like to
now,
begin.
Now, Republicans are going to try and derail this with points of parliamentary procedure throughout. But what we just heard from Bill Taylor was pretty devastating.
You said in your testimony that one of your staff was present with Ambassador Sondland on the day after the July 25th phone call. Is that right?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
And as your staff related the event to you, your staff member could overhear Mr. Sondland on the phone. We could overhear the president on the phone with Mr. Sondland. Is that right?
That's correct.
So the president must have been speaking loud enough on the phone. This was a cell phone, I take it?
It was a cell phone.
The president must have been speaking loud enough for your staff member to be able to overhear this?
It was.
And what your staff member could overhear was President Trump asking Ambassador Sondland about, quote, the investigations. Is that right?
That's correct.
Now, I think you testified also that you had come to understand that the term investigations was a term that Ambassador Sondland, as well as Volker, used to mean matters related to the 2016 elections and to the investigations of Burisma and the Bidens. Is that correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chairman.
So your staff member overhears the president asking about the investigations, meaning Burisma and the Bidens in 2016. And Ambassador Sondland told President Trump that the Ukrainians were ready to move forward?
He did.
And I think you said that after the call, when your staff asked Ambassador Sondland what President Trump thought of Ukraine, his response was that President Trump cares more about the investigations of Biden. Is that right?
And Burisma. Yes, sir.
Well, I mean, Ukraine, Schmukraine. Let's get to the good stuff.
He cares more about that than he does about Ukraine.
Yes, sir.
During your testimony, Ambassador Taylor, you also said that more Ukrainians would undoubtedly die without U.S. assistance. Why is that?
Mr. Chairman, the security assistance that we provide, it takes many forms. One of the components of that assistance is counter-battery radar. Another component are sniper weapons. These weapons and this assistance it allows the Ukrainian military to deter further incursions by the Russians against their own, against Ukrainian territory. If that further incursion, further aggression were to take place, more Ukrainians would die. So it is a deterrent effect that these weapons provide. It's also the ability, it gives the Ukrainians the ability to negotiate from a position of a little more strength when they negotiate an end to the war in Donbas, negotiating with the Russians. This also is a way that would reduce the number of Ukrainians who would die.
I take it if the provision of U.S. military assistance would save Ukrainian lives, that any delay in that assistance may also cost Ukrainian lives. Is that true?
Mr. Chairman, of course, it's hard to draw any direct lines between any particular element of security assistance and any particular death on the battlefield. But it is certainly true that that assistance had enabled Ukrainian armed forces to be effective and deter and to be able to take countermeasures to the attacks that the Russians had.
And I think you said that a Ukrainian soldier lost their life while you were visiting Donbas.
We keep very careful track of the casualties, and I noticed on the next day the information that we got that one was killed, four soldiers were wounded on that day.
And indeed, Ukrainians lose their lives every week.
Every week.
I think you also testified that Russia was watching closely to gauge the level of American support for the Ukrainian government. Why is that significant?
This is significant, Mr. Chairman, because the Ukrainians, in particular under this new administration, are eager to end this war. And they are eager to end it in a way that the Russians leave their territory. These negotiations, like all negotiations, are difficult. Ukrainians would like to be able to negotiate from a position of strength, or at least more strength than they now have. Part of that strength, part of the ability of the Ukrainians to negotiate against the Russians, with the Russians, for an end to the war in Donbas, depends on the United States and other international support. If we withdraw or suspend or threaten to withdraw our security assistance, that's a message to the Ukrainians, but it's at least as important, as your question indicates, Mr. Chairman, to the Russians, who are looking for any sign of weakness or any sign that we are withdrawing our support for Ukraine.
And so when the Ukrainians learned of the suspension of the military aid, either privately or when others learned publicly, the Russians would be learning also. And they would take that as a lack of robust U.S. support for Ukraine. Is that right?
That's correct, sir.
And that would weaken Ukraine in negotiating an end to the war in Donbas.
It would.
People watching, I'm sure, are interested in how military assistance and diplomatic support for Ukraine affects Ukraine, but even more so interested in how does this affect our national security. Now, I think you said that if we believe in a principle of sovereignty of nations where countries get to determine their own economic, political, and security alliances, we have to support Ukraine in its fight, that the kind of aggression we see by Russia can't stand. How is it important to American national security that we provide for a robust defense of Ukraine's sovereignty?
Mr. Chairman, as my colleague, Deputy Assistant Secretary George Kent, described, we have a national security policy, a national defense policy that identifies Russia and China as adversaries. The Russians are violating all of the rules, treaties, understandings that they committed to that actually kept the peace in Europe for nearly 70 years. Until they invaded Ukraine in 2014, they had abided by sovereignty of nations, of inviolability of borders. That rule of law, that order that kept the peace in Europe and allowed for prosperity as well as peace in Europe, was violated by the Russians. And if we don't push back on that, on those violations, then that will continue. And that, Mr. Chairman, affects us. It affects the world that we live in, that our children will grow up in, and our grandchildren. This affects the kind of world that we want to see abroad. So that affects our national interest very directly. Ukraine is on the front line of that conflict.
I want to thank you both for your decades of service to the country, and now recognize Mr. Goldman for questioning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ambassador Taylor, on the heels of you discussing the importance of the security assistance to Ukraine, I want to go to the end of the timeline where you learned that that security assistance was conditioned on Ukraine announcing the investigations that the president wanted. And in particular, on September 9th of this year, you texted Ambassador Sondland and Volker, and the text message should be on the screen in front of you. And if you could read what you wrote.
As I said on the phone, I think it's crazy to withhold security assistance for help with a political campaign.
What did you mean when you said you thought it was crazy?
Ms. Goldman, I meant that because of the importance of security assistance that we had just described and had a conversation with the chairman. Because that was so important, that security assistance was so important for Ukraine as well as our own national interest, to withhold that assistance for no good reason other than help with the political campaign made no sense. It was counterproductive to all of what we had been trying to do. It was illogical. It could not be explained. It was crazy.
When you say all of what we were trying to do, what do you mean by we?
I mean that the United States was trying to support Ukraine as a frontline state against Russian attack. And again, the whole notion of a rules-based order was being threatened by the Russians in Ukraine. So our security assistance was designed to support Ukraine. It was not just the United States. It was all of our allies.
When you reference help with a political campaign in this text message, what did you mean?
I meant that the investigation of Burisma and the Bidens was clearly identified by Mr. Giuliani in public for months as a way to get information on the two Bidens.
And that investigation, at the very least, was mentioned by President Trump in the July 25th phone call with President Zelensky. Is that right?
As we now know, yes. On September 25th, that transcript was released.
Ambassador Taylor, in your decades of military service and diplomatic service representing the United States around the world, have you ever seen another example of foreign aid conditioned on the personal or political interests of the President of the United States?
No, Mr. Goldman, I've not.
Mr. Kent,
Ronald
that
Reagan
vital
wanted a
military
pair of shoes
assistance
once, I
that
think, from...
was not the only thing that President Trump was withholding from Ukraine. What else was contingent on Ukraine initiating these investigations?
Well, as we've talked earlier today, the possibility of a White House meeting was being held contingent to an announcement.
How important to President Zelensky was a White House meeting?
New leaders, particularly countries that are trying to have good footing in the international arena, see a meeting with the U.S. President in the Oval Office at the White House as the ultimate sign of endorsement and support from the United States.
And President Zelensky was a relatively new president, is that right?
That's correct. He was elected on April 21st, and his government was formed after parliamentary elections in July.
Would a White House meeting for President Zelensky boost his legitimacy as a new president in Ukraine?
It would primarily boost his leverage to negotiate with Vladimir Putin about the Russian occupation of 7% of Ukrainian territory.
Mr. Ken, is pressuring Ukraine to conduct what I believe you've called political investigations a part of U.S. foreign policy to promote the rule of law in Ukraine and around the world?
It is not.
Is it in the national interest of the United States?
In my opinion, it is not.
Why not?
Because our policies, particularly in promoting the rule of law, are designed to help countries, and in Eastern Europe and Central Europe, that is overcoming the legacy of communism. In the communist system, in particular, the Prosecutor General Office was used to suppress and persecute citizens, not promote the rule of law. So in helping these countries reach their own aspirations to join the Western community of nations and live lives of dignity, helping them have the rule of law with strong institutions is the purpose of our policy.
So in other words, it is a purpose of our foreign policy to encourage foreign nations to refrain from conducting political investigations. Is that right?
Correct. And in fact, as a matter of policy, not of programming, we oftentimes raise our concerns, usually in private, with countries that we feel are engaged in selective political prosecution and persecution of their opponents.
Ambassador Taylor, now that we've established that you ultimately did understand that President Trump was withholding the security assistance and a White House meeting from Ukraine until they announced these investigations to benefit his reelection campaign, Let's go back a little bit in time to when you first learned about this conditionality. And on September 1st, so a little more than a week before that text we just read, you sent another text to Ambassadors Sondland and Volker, which should be also be on the screen in front of you. And if you could read what you wrote to them.
Are we now saying that security assistance and White House meeting are conditioned on investigations?
This is when
and Ambassador Sondland
realizes,
call me.
He's wearing a wire.
Now, what information have you learned that prompted you to write this text message?
I had learned that in Warsaw, after the meeting Vice President Pence had with President Zelensky, Ambassador Sondland had had meetings there and had described to Mr. Yermak, the assistant to President Zelensky, that the security assistance was also held pending announcement.
Both.
By
everything held.
President Zelensky in public of these investigations. Before that, I had only understood from Ambassador Sondland that the White House meeting was conditioned. And at this time, after I heard of this conversation, it struck me, it was clear to me that security assistance was also being held.
You said previously that you were alarmed to learn this. Why were you alarmed?
It's one thing to try to leverage a meeting in the White House. It's another thing, I thought, to leverage security assistance to a country at war, dependent on both the security assistance and the demonstration of support. It was much more alarming. The White House meeting was one thing. Security assistance was much more alarming.
Now, Ambassador Taylor, you, in your opening statement, you outlined a very detailed timeline. And, in fact, we have a written copy here, and you included some phrases and words in quotations. Did you take notes of this conversation on September 1st with Ambassador Sondland?
I did.
And did you take notes related to most of the conversations, if not all of them, that you recited in your opening statement?
All of them, Mr. Goldman.
And what do those quotations that you include in your opening statement reflect?
They reflect my notes on the exact words that I heard on that call. So it was, if I put those in quotes, that meant that those are the words used on that phone call or in that conversation.
And did you review those notes before you drafted your opening statement and came here to testify?
I did.
Now, is that how, for example, you remember that Ambassador Sondland was on a train from Paris to London, you know, during a call in July?
That's correct.
And you are aware, I presume, that the State Department has not provided those notes to the committee. Is that right?
I am aware.
So we don't have the benefit of reviewing them to ask you these questions?
Correct. I understand that they may be coming sooner or later.
Well, we would welcome that. You also testified earlier, Ambassador Sondland, or Ambassador Taylor, that President Trump had delegated some matters overseeing Ukraine policy to Ambassador Sondland, who is a big inaugural supporter of President Trump,
though
Ukraine is not in his domain of the European Union. Is that right?
Several participants in the meeting in the Oval Office with President Trump, with the delegation to the inauguration of President Zelensky, told me of that conversation, and it was at that meeting, as I understand it from several participants, that President Trump asked the participants to work with Mr. Giuliani on Ukraine policy.
Did you come to understand that Ambassador Sondland had a direct line of communication into President Trump?
I did.
And you testified, in that text message, Ambassador Sondland says to call him after you wrote that. Did you, in fact, call him?
I did.
And what did he say to you?
He said that I was wrong about President Trump's intent, that there was no quid pro quo.
Tell him no quid pro quo. But?
But did he say anything after that?
But?
Did he describe to you, I believe you said, I'll refresh your memory, that
thank you.
He mentioned something in your opening statement. You said that he said that everything, I believe, and you had that in quotes, was actually contingent on the initiation of these investigations.
No quid pro quo.
What did he mean
but
by everything?
But I need all that stuff for them to get their stuff.
Was the security assistance and the White House meeting.
And I believe you also testified that he said he had made a mistake in relaying a message to the Ukrainians. What was that mistake?
The mistake, he told me, was earlier he had told, presumably President Zelensky and Mr. Yermak, that what was necessary for the White House meeting was the pursuit of these investigations. And he said he recognized that that was a mistake. It was not just the White House meeting that was dependent on the investigations. He said it was now everything. It included the security assistance.
So it was not just the White House meeting, it was also the security assistance.
Yes, sir.
And so even though President Trump was saying repeatedly that there is no quid pro quo, Ambassador Sondland relayed to you that the facts of the matter were that the White House meeting and the security assistance were conditioned on the announcement of these investigations. Is that your understanding?
That's my understanding.
Now, you reference a television interview and a desire for President Trump to put Zelensky in a public box, which you also have in quotes. Was that in your notes?
It was in my notes.
And what did you understand that to mean, to put Zelensky in a public box?
I understood that to mean that President Trump, through Ambassador Sondland, was asking for President Zelensky to very publicly commit to these investigations, that it was not sufficient to do this in private, that this needed to be a very public statement.
And did you understand why it was needed to be in public as opposed to a private confirmation?
I had no further information on that.
Now, during this time period in early September, did you come to understand that from your conversations with the Ukrainians or other individuals that Ukraine felt pressure to initiate these investigations because of the conditionality of the White House meeting and the security assistance?
Mr. Scobin, here's what I know. I got several questions. Other officials got several questions as well from Ukrainians asking about the security assistance. So what I know is the security assistance was very important to the Ukrainians. They had begun to hear from Ambassador Sondland that the security assistance was not going to come until the investigations were pursued. What I heard from the defense minister, what Senator Johnson and Senator Murphy heard in their conversation with President Zelensky, was the clear concern, the urgent concern that the Ukrainians had about the security assistance.
Now, you also described a conversation that you had with Ambassador Sondland a week later on September 8th. And in that conversation, in your opening statement, you described how Ambassador Sondland used the term stalemate. What did you understand the concern about a stalemate to be?
Ambassador Sondland said that if President Zelensky did not clear things up in public, we would be at a stalemate. He began that, again, by repeating, this is not a quid pro quo, but if President Zelensky did not clear things up in public, we would be at a stalemate. And what I understood in that meeting, the meaning of stalemate was the security assistance would not come.
So even though he said the words, there were no quid pro quo, he then went on to say, but the security assistance will not come unless these investigations are done. Is that what you're saying?
My understanding, that's what was meant by stalemate.
You also described in your opening statement a discussion you had about President Trump being a businessman who wanted to have people pay up before signing the check. And what did you understand that to mean?
This was an explanation that Ambassador Sondland gave me about his understanding of President Trump's thought process. Ambassador Sondland is a businessman. President Trump's a businessman. He was explaining to me the relationship, the understanding that a businessman would have when he was about to sign a check. And by that, he clearly meant that President Trump was thinking about or had in front of him the possibility of providing security assistance to Ukraine. It was similar to writing a check to someone who you're about to send. He used that analogy very clearly to indicate that this would require something. If that person owed him something before he signed the check, he wanted to get whatever he was owed paid back to him. And Ambassador Volker used very similar language about a week later, which indicates to me that they had that conversation as well.
Did Ukraine owe anything to the United States?
Ms. Goldman, they didn't. They owed appreciation for the support.
That's what I was asking for. A little appreciation in the form of a little, you scratch my back, I scratch yours.
There was nothing owed to President Trump.
Need just a little bit of, I need a taste.
But you understood the upshot of this comment made by both Ambassador Sondland and Ambassador Volker to be that President Trump believed that Ukraine owed him something personally. Is that accurate?
It's hard to understand, but there was a feeling by President Trump that he, and this came out in the transcript. I'm sorry, this came out in the discussion with the inaugural delegation when they came back to have a conversation with President Trump on May 23rd. That he had a feeling of having been wronged by the Ukrainians. And so this was something that he thought they owed him to fix that wrong.
Right, but what he was talking about, as you understood it, because in the context of the conversation, is that what he owed him were these investigations that he wanted.
That would have been to fix the wrong, exactly.
That's the way I would take the payment.
Those investigations into the 2016 election.
Folks,
and Biden and Burisma.
You are listening to Daniel Goldman. He's
now,
the Democratic
during this early period in September,
counsel.
We've talked a little bit about
hired a couple months ago by Schiff for this committee, formally dealt with mobsters from, I think, the Southern District of New York.
Regardless of what,
and he is continuing to question Bill Taylor, the acting U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, and his testimony, Taylor's testimony, his opening statement was pretty devastating. Goldman's just walking through and hitting all these points again to lock them down. We have yet to hear the Republicans question
two investigations that would benefit Donald Trump's reelection. Is that what you understood the facts to be?
Mr. Goldman, what I can do here for you today is tell you what I heard from people. And in this case, it was what I heard from Ambassador Sondland. He described conditions for the security assistance and the White House meeting in those terms. That is, that were dependent upon, conditioned on, pursuing these investigations.
And you heard that from Ambassador Sondland himself, correct?
Correct.
And you also heard a similar story from Mr. Morrison as well. Is that right?
Who also talked to...
This has been the nature of the testimony, right there. I mean, that's all you really need to know. He's heard it from two different people
who
are on the conversation.
Was substantially similar to what Mr. Sondland
recounted to you, Trump wanted a quid pro quo. You guys get the assistance that Congress has...
Now that everything is out in the public and we're
here
in this public hearing,
and a visit to the White
they
House,
felt no pressure from
if you
President
get
Trump.
An investigation. Here we go. Hold
it
on.
Was your clear understanding, was it not, that in early September, when the pressure campaign was still secret, that the Ukrainians believed that they needed to announce these public investigations? Is that right?
Ms. Goldman, I know that. The Ukrainians were very concerned about the security assistance. And I know that they were prepared or preparing to make a public statement, that is, with a CNN interview, that that was being planned. Those are the two pieces that I know.
So by September, they knew they had to do that to get that money.
It, right?
That was the implication. That was certainly the implication.
The biggest piece of testimony that has come out that we didn't know before was that an associate of Bill Taylor's, staff member, heard President Trump on the phone with Ambassador Sondland saying that Trump, that Sondland responded and following the call, the member of my staff, and this is what he said, asked Ambassador Sondland what President Trump thought about Ukraine. Ambassador Sondland responded that President Trump cares more about the investigations of Biden, which Giuliani was pressing for. Now, it was also announced today, after that statement, that there are going to be two new closed-door depositions, David Holmes and Mark Sandy. These are people who could very well have been one of these staff members to Bill Taylor. We're going to continue to follow this, folks, and at one point, we will put together some of the key moments of this. But Goldman is questioning Taylor, and this is all relevant stuff.
I don't know what Ambassador Bolton had in mind.
And was that in reference to...
We'll just let it go for a second.
In that meeting related to the White House meeting... that President Zelensky wanted and in connection to the investigations?
The context of that comment was the discussion that Mr. Danyluk, who was Mr. Bolton's counterpart, Ukrainian counterpart, the National Security Advisor, had with Mr. Bolton. And that conversation was very substantive up until the point where the White House meeting was raised, and Mr. Ambassador Sondland intervened to talk about the investigations. It was at that point that Ambassador Bolton ceased the meeting, closed the meeting, finished the meeting, and told his staff to report this meeting to the lawyers. And he also later then indicated to Fiona Hill, who was also a participant on NSC staff, that he, Ambassador Bolton, didn't want to be associated with this drug deal. So it was the implication was it was the domestic politics that was being cooked up.
And did Ambassador Sondland say this in front of the Ukrainian officials, to your understanding?
Ambassador Sondland, in the meeting where Ambassador Bolton was having a conversation with his counterpart, raised the issue of investigations being important to come before the White House meeting that had just been raised.
Well, and Ukrainian officials were there.
And Ukrainian officials were in that meeting, yes, sir.
Now, around this same time in mid-July, did you have any discussions with Ukrainian officials about these investigations?
I don't recall.
Well, let me show you a text message that you wrote on July 21st, where you wrote it again to Ambassadors Sondland and Volker. And if you could just read what you wrote here on July 21st.
Gordon, One thing Kurt and I talked about yesterday was Sasha Danieluk's point that President Zelensky is sensitive about Ukraine being taken seriously, not merely as an instrument in Washington domestic re-election politics.
And Sasha Danieluk, I think you just said, is Ambassador Bolton's counterpart, right?
He's the national security advisor to the... He was. He's no longer, but was at the time.
What did you understand it to mean when that Zelensky had concerns about being an instrument in Washington domestic re-election politics?
Mr. Danieluk understood that these investigations were pursuant to Mr. Giuliani's request to develop information, to find information about Burisma and the Bidens. This was very well known in public. Mr. Giuliani had made this point clear in several instances in the beginning, in the springtime. And Mr. Danieluk was aware that that was a problem.
And would you agree that because President Zelensky is worried about this, they understood at least that there was some pressure for them to pursue these investigations? Is that fair?
Mr. Danieluk indicated that President Zelensky certainly understood it, that he did not want to get involved in these type of activities.
Now, I'm going to move ahead now to July 25th, which was when President Trump and President Zelensky had the phone call. But before we get to the phone call, I want to show both of you a text message, neither of you is on this text message. It is between Ambassador Volker and Andrei Yermak, a top aide to President Zelensky. I will read it because neither of you is on it. Ambassador Volker says, "Good lunch, thanks. Heard from White House. Assuming President Z convinces Trump he will investigate / get to the bottom of what happened in 2016, we will nail down date for visit to Washington. Good luck. See you tomorrow. Kurt." And this was a half hour, less than a half hour, before the call actually occurred.
President Z could be anybody.
Now, Ambassador Taylor, was Ambassador Volker with you in Ukraine at this time?
He was.
Did you know that he was prepping President Zelensky for this phone call with President Trump in this way?
Not in this way, Mr. Goldman, but I knew that Ambassador Volker was prepping Ukrainians for the phone call earlier on. That is, at a meeting in Toronto on July 2nd, Ambassador Volker had a conversation with President Zelensky and had indicated in a phone call that he, at that time, was going to talk Mr. Zelensky, President Zelensky, through the steps that need to be taken in order to get to the phone call.
Understood. And you testified earlier that the security assistance had already been frozen, to your knowledge, at least by July 18th. Is that right?
That's correct.
So that was just a week earlier than this.
That's correct.
So, just so we're clear, Ambassador Taylor, before this July 25th call, President Trump had frozen the security assistance that Ukraine needed, and that the White House meeting was conditioned on Ukraine initiating this investigation, and that had been relayed to the Ukrainians. Is that an accurate state of play at this time?
That's an accurate state of play. I, at that point, had no indication that any discussion of the security assistance being subject to conditioned on investigations had taken place.
Right, but you understood that the White House meeting was.
That's correct.
All right, let's move ahead to this July 25th call and between the presidents. Now, am I correct that neither of you were on this call? Is that right, Mr. Kent?
That's correct.
And you were neither correct. As well? So you both read it after it was released publicly at the end of September?
Yes.
Yes.
I want to spend just a little time reading the transcript, as we've been encouraged to do. And I want to particularly note four excerpts of the transcript, one that relates to the security assistance we've been talking about, another that discusses a favor that President Trump asked of President Zelensky, a third where President Trump asks the Ukrainian president to investigate his political opponent, former Vice President Biden, and then a final one where the Ukrainian president directly links the desired White House visit to the political investigations that President Trump wanted. So let's look at the first excerpt, which is near the beginning of the call when President Zelensky discusses the military aid that the U.S. provides to Ukraine. He says, "I would also like to thank you for your great support in the area of defense. We are ready to continue to cooperate for the next steps. Specifically, we are almost ready to buy more javelins from the United States for defense purposes." Now, at the time of this phone call, Ambassador Taylor and Mr. Kent, you both knew that the aid had been frozen. Is that right?
That's yes. Correct.
And Ambassador Taylor, you testified that President Trump obviously also knew that the aid had been frozen as well, since he was responsible for doing that. Is that correct?
That's what I had been told. That's what we heard on that conference call, yes.
But to neither of your knowledge, the Ukrainians were not aware of that at that point.
Not to my knowledge.
Not to my knowledge.
But right after President Zelensky thanks President Trump for his great support in the area of defense, President Trump then says, and we'll go to the next excerpt, "I want you to do us a favor, though, because our country has been through a lot and Ukraine knows a lot about it. I would like you to find out what happened with this whole situation with Ukraine. They say CrowdStrike. I guess you have one of your wealthy people. The server, they say Ukraine has it." And then at the end of the paragraph, he says, "Whatever you can do, it's very important that you do it if that's possible." Now, Mr. Kent, you've testified a little bit about how important this White House meeting was to President Zelensky. How would you expect a new Ukrainian president to interpret a request for a favor from the President of the United States?
I cannot interpret the mind of President Zelensky, other than to say that it was very clear that what they were hoping to get out of this meeting was a date and a confirmation that he could come to Washington.
Obviously, you can't put yourself in the mind, but if the Ukrainian president, for a country that's so dependent on the United States for all things, including military assistance, is requested to do a favor, how do you think the Ukrainians would interpret that?
Well, if you go further into the call record as part of this, and we don't have it on screen, but to the best of my recollection, reading it after it was released on September 25th, President Zelensky went into having whatever your problems were, that was the old team, I've got a new team, and we will do whatever is appropriate and be transparent and honest about it. I don't remember the exact words, but he was trying to be, in his own words in response, be responsive to conduct the business of Ukrainian government in a transparent and honest manner.
Now, when he talks about this CrowdStrike and the server, what do you understand this to be a reference to?
To be honest, I had not heard of CrowdStrike until I read this transcript on September 25th.
Because he never watches Fox, that's why.
I understand it has to do with
liberal media.
The story that there's a server with missing emails. I also understand that one of the owners of CrowdStrike is a Russian-American. I'm not aware of any Ukrainian connection to the company.
Now, are you aware that this is all part of a larger allegation that Ukraine interfered in the 2016 election?
Yes, that is my understanding.
And to your knowledge, is there any factual basis to support the allegation that Ukraine interfered in the 2016 election?
To my knowledge, there is no factual basis, no.
And okay, fact, but there is basis.
Interfere in the 2016 election?
I think it's amply clear that Russian interference was at the heart of the interference in the 2016 election cycle.
Let's move to the third excerpt that I mentioned related to Vice President Biden. And it says, "The other thing, there's a lot of talk about Biden's son." This is President Trump speaking. "That Biden stopped the prosecution and a lot of people want to find out about that. So whatever you can do with the Attorney General would be great. Biden went around bragging that he stopped the prosecution, so if you can look into it, it sounds horrible." Now, at the time of this call, Vice President Biden was the front runner for the Democratic nomination in the 2020 election. And Mr. Krent, are you familiar, as you indicate in your opening statement, about these allegations related to Vice President Biden?
I am.
And to your knowledge, is there any factual basis to support those allegations?
None whatsoever.
When Vice President Biden acted in Ukraine, did he act in accordance with official U.S. policy?
He did.
Now, let's go to then the last excerpt that I wanted to highlight, which is President Zelensky speaking, and he says, I also wanted to thank you for your invitation to visit the United States, specifically Washington, D.C. On the other hand, I also want to assure you that we will be very serious about the case and we will work on the investigation.
Coincidence.
Now, Ambassador Taylor, right after President Zelensky mentions his much desired Washington visit, he says, on the other hand,
let me see both your hands.
And then says that Ukraine will be very serious about the investigation. Is this the same link between the White House visit and the investigations that Ambassador Volker had texted to Andrei Yermak just a few minutes before this conversation?
That's my assumption.
Now, just to summarize what we've just read in this July 25th call between the presidents, the Ukrainian president thanked President Trump for security assistance that President Trump had just frozen, to which President Trump responded that he wanted President Zelensky to do him a favor, though, by investigating the 2016 U.S. election and the Bidens. Then President Zelensky says that he will pursue these investigations right after he mentions the White House visit. Is that your understanding, Ambassador Taylor, of what we just read?
Yes.
And Mr. Kent, is that yours?
Yes.
No one has even said quid pro quo.
The majority time has expired.
Nobody said the words.
Would you gentlemen like a brief recess? Well, let's take a five-minute recess.
All right, they're going to take
we'll
a five-minute recess.
Questioning.
Should we reset maybe right now?
Yeah, we can do that.
All right. So, ladies and gentlemen, what we're going to do in just about, 30 seconds? In about 30 seconds, we're going to restart the stream. You will be able to in fact, can we put a link in the description of the existing stream right now?
Yeah, we can do that.
All right, so let's put a link in the description of the existing stream so that when we move to the new one, you'll be there. They're going to take a five-minute break. When they come back, we're going to see the Republicans now are going to have 45 minutes of questioning of Bill Taylor and Kent. Now, I would bet that it's going to focus on the idea, didn't Sondland say to you, the president said no quid pro quo? And that's where you end the conversation, because Sondland did say to Bill Taylor, the president said no quid pro quo. It's just that the sentence continues on. But he did say, we do want this for that. He didn't literally say this for that, but he did say what we want. If they want that security assistance, and they want the meeting, they need to give us the investigations. There's going to be that, but then it's all going to be about Hunter Biden. It's all going to be about Hunter Biden. It may be about the 2016 thing. Because the name of the game for them, look, Donald Trump's going to be impeached in the House. There's no doubt about it. It's just, it's inescapable. It's completely implausible. Never mind from a political standpoint, but just what we've heard, that you wouldn't impeach him. What happens in the Senate, you know, I would bet is that he will not be convicted. There is a very difficult decision for about four or five Republican senators to make. Maybe they've already made that decision, but it's going to get, I think it's going to get harder before, you know, before we get to that vote. The name of the game for the Republicans here is to A, provide enough sort of noise that the signal gets lost, not for half the country, but for, I mean, not for the whole country, but for, you know, about half the country. I think there is probably no one who thinks that Donald Trump is going to win the majority of votes in 2020. I think there's reason to believe that Donald Trump could win the Electoral College in 2020. And so the people that the Republicans now need to hear a distorted and low signal information is who they're going for. And so that's what we're going to hear from these folks in from the Republicans.
after those 45 minutes, it's possible that the thing ends. But Bill Taylor's testimony was impressive. And the addendum, we've mentioned this before, the addendum. All right, well, let's take a break and let's go, and we will talk about this, and we will recap all this. So you don't even need to put a thing. Let's just, are we ready to relaunch the new one?
Yeah, we'll need to kill this.
Okay, we're going to kill this stream. The link is in part two, is now in the description. You just click on there. We'll be back in literally 30 seconds.